If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Science vs. Fiction, the podcast for movie buffs and science nerds and those who are those things combined. I am your co-host, Scott Weinberg, and I am happy to introduce who is new to podcasting, my good friend, Mr. Steven DeGennaro. Steven?
Hi, everybody. Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah, tell everybody your credentials. If you're listening to this show, it's probably maybe because you either read my film reviews, see my movie tweets, or listen to my other podcast, the excellent 80s All Over. And if you are, thank you. So you know my credentials, but Steven, let's hear yours.
So I took a rather circuitous path to podcasting and film in general. I've always been a film buff since I was a very, very young man. I took a brief diversion in my 20s to earn 3 degrees in astrophysics, during which time I started working as a sound guy on movies and later became a writer and director.
And then, okay, and we'll get into your degrees a bit more in a second, but that leads right into the story of how you and I met. So why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners how that happened.
Well, so Scott and I met, I directed a movie called Found Footage 3D, and we met through a mutual friend at Fantastic Fest one year, and I had written a cameo for a blogger slash journalist slash critic and asked Scott to come out and play it, and he did a cameo as himself in the film and then became a producer, and we've been thick as thieves ever since.
Yep, and we are, I'm going to be hopefully producing something that Steven wrote, a really cool, quiet gothic horror film, and we've written a few things together that we hope to get produced, but I thought I really enjoy doing 80s All Over with my good friend Drew McWeeny and our producer Bobby. I think it's a really great concept, and I've been throwing around 3 or 4 new ideas for a second show because I really do enjoy podcasting. And I thought, well, the key is, what assets do I have? And, you know, friends count as assets, right? And if Steven was just like an English teacher, he wouldn't have much to contribute to this podcast necessarily. But the man has 3 degrees. Now, Steven, be specific, because we're going to have a lot of science nerds listening to the show, professional and amateur, and they want to know, what are your credentials?
Okay, so I got my BA in physics, specifically space physics and astronomy, from Rice University in 1999. I got a MA in astronomy from UT Austin in 2005, I think. And then I got my PhD also from UT Austin in 2009, at which point I basically left the field and became a filmmaker. As you do.
All right. Now, yeah, a lot of people out there, this might make a lot of people feel better because almost none of my friends have followed their major in college. None. I mean, I did because this is my only discernible skill. I studied film and English in college. But, like, I know friends who took journalism who went to work for their parents. And I have friends who had a degree, went like, pre-law and then married a rich girl and never pursued pre-law beyond that. You know, stuff like that. So how weird was it for you to like go for like, I mean, that's how many years of education in total?
I mean, so I guess 4 years of undergrad and about 5.5 or so. So it was, yeah, there was a break in between where I taught high school for a little while and managed a Blockbuster Video.
Now, I certainly don't want you to think this is the case, but did you ever at one point think, God, what a waste those years have been if I just now become a filmmaker, and isn't my education and these degrees somewhat wasted?
Not at all. I mean, just actually tomorrow I am participating in a conference that my former advisor set up to talk about the software that I wrote while I was in graduate school. So I still sort of have one foot in that world a little bit, not so much anymore. I've published about 4 or 5 papers since I graduated, just based on data that I took on telescopes while I was in school.
One of my favorite skills of yours that you have is that, thank God for this podcast, you are a very, very seasoned sound designer, both on set and post-production. Why do you think that was your entry point into filmmaking, sound specifically?
Sound is always is something that I did since, I got my first professional sound recording gig at 13. I owned a little 4-track cassette recorder, which at the time, you couldn't go out and buy a $15 microphone and start podcasting back in those days. So I had I had this 4-track cassette recorder later on an 8-track reel-to-reel recorder would record bands and music all throughout high school and college. And then when I decided that I wanted to get involved in the film industry, that seemed like that was something that I had been doing for 15 or 20 years at that point, at least as a hobby and sort of semi-professionally. So it was like, all right, well, this is something I know that I can do, and I can teach myself the additional skills to do it for film, and that can be an entryway into starting in the film business.
And in between your own films and other films, shorts and features, you worked as sound design or recordist on, 35, 40 films?
Oh, in total? Like 200, over 200.
Okay. So, yeah, I was trying to be modest for you. And you've done a lot of teaching. You occasionally teach at UT for sound design.
I did. I taught for 6 years. I taught sound design and mixing at UT in the film department for 6 years or so. I only stopped because I had a baby, and now he's the focus of my attention.
What else do we want to cover in our intro? Why this show? Okay. I have about a dozen different podcast ideas. Some are very basic but fun, and a couple are kind of high concept. I thought 80s All Over was high concept, meaning that, people hear it described in 2 sentences and they go, ooh, I'd like to listen to that. And I thought this would be another one because I think movie fans, especially sci-fi fans, they don't mind the discussion of does that science work or is that realistic in the film. I think that where movie fans start to have a problem is when scientists want fact to take precedence over art or fiction.
Yeah, I think that was part of what makes you and I uniquely qualified to do this podcast is because, somebody like, Neil deGrasse Tyson comes in and doesn't necessarily have a storytelling background, but has the science background. And other people obviously have the storytelling background, but don't have the science background, and I in particular, and you somewhat have both, and so I can kind of speak to both ends of this equation. Where like there are plenty of times where bad science in a movie completely kills it for me, and there are just as many times where bad science is very clearly done in service of the story and in service of sort of moving things along a little bit quicker, and you just sort of learn how to go, okay, well, that's in this world, that's how that thing works.
Right, and I think movie fans would like to know that there are people out there like you and your wife who are hardcore scientists who take hard science seriously, but you don't sit there with a checklist and go, this movie got 3 things wrong, therefore it's garbage. Like, that's like, do you think doctors watch like ER or Grey's Anatomy and just say, oh my God, no, they know it's mostly garbage and they enjoy it.
I imagine, most police officers and lawyers watching any of the Law and Orders are cringing at how ridiculously wrong they get. Even as a layperson, I'm aware of how wrong they get most of that stuff, but they have an hour to tell their story. They're not going to sit there. A real court might spend an hour just on one objection, and that's right. Not very compelling television. So you have to just sort of like let it go in certain contexts. Now, what bugs me, where I get mad, is when a movie gets it like 95% right, and then they get something egregiously wrong in a way that is not necessary. Like, okay, if you'd have done this the right way, you could have done it just as compellingly and it would have been just as interesting. But you have now trained me to think this movie knows what it's talking about. It's following the rules. It takes place in our world, except for, X technology that's somewhat different than our world. That's the fiction part of the science fiction. And then it gets something wrong and it just really, it's like sand in the bottom of your shoe.
Is that a phrase? Is that a thing, Sandy?
No. It's like a pebble in the bottom of your shoe.
There you go. A pebble in your shoe. That's a cliche. There we go. So I don't want you to name any specifically, but like, can you think off the top of your head of a decent sci-fi movie that you were like about halfway through and it got something so wrong, either through laziness or just through bad science that you just like threw up your hands and went, ah, gah.
Well, I mean, the movie that comes to mind is Gravity, which I immensely enjoyed and is one of my favorite science fiction movies of all time. So it didn't at all kill me, but there's a moment in that. And you know, hopefully we'll get around to talking about that movie on an episode in the future. But there's a moment in late in that where it was just like, wait, no, come on, guys, that's not how it works. You've gotten everything else right. Why would you get this wrong?
Right.
And it was kind of baffling. But then, you know, again, you just go, okay, you know what, I'm going to go with it. Because clearly that's, you know, they wanted to tell that story that way. So
right. So the format in theory is we're both huge, huge movie buffs, especially science fiction. Steven is a scientist. I am a film critic. We're both very experienced in our fields. And the hope is that we can bring some fun, insightful conversations about these movies. Not to say, well, just to pick an easy target, Armageddon, the science in that movie is ridiculous, therefore it's garbage. Well, it might be garbage, but let's discuss about, like, why. Let's discuss specifically why, because you know what? Lots of really good science fiction movies get a lot of science wrong, so it's not really fair to just knock a silly movie because it also gets a lot of things wrong. But when we get to Armageddon, I am going to look at Steven and go, give me a couple of things this movie got right.
And I will have to rack my brain.
And another thing that we came up with was instead of doing, this is the perfect example of how things grow when you bring somebody else into it. When I gave 80s All Over to Drew, it was a very formative, simplistic idea, and Drew made it 5 times better. So when I came to Steven and I gave him the basic bare bones of this, he said a week later, I got a better idea. Why don't we find pairings instead of it just being one movie per episode? Pair two similar or notably dissimilar science fiction films together, and then we can compare and contrast. Steven, yeah. Why is that interesting?
I mean, what I like about this as a scientist is it gives you an opportunity to sort of like show, you know, one movie that got it right and one movie that got it wrong, or one movie that that tweaked something in a way that added to the artistry of the finished product, and one movie that just ignored science because clearly the people that made it don't have any clue what they're doing. So to me, that contrast, that being able to sort of pit these two movies together to look at them on these two scales of scientific intelligence and artistic merit, and that those two things don't necessarily have to be correlated.
What we want to avoid is obviously the snobbiness that can sometimes come from like an empirically scientific approach, because with all respect to Neil Tyson, who I think is often very tongue-in-cheek when he says snarky things about movies, I truly do. You want somebody who understands science, but also why it's okay to fudge the rules in the service of your story.
Yeah, well, I think as we go forward, we're going to see movies that get the science right and stink, and movies that get the science wrong and are a total blast, and movies, in fact, sometimes that are, that could be better if they didn't slavishly stick to real science. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, again, I think these two things are not necessarily coupled with one another, although I think you will often find that, some people that do their homework, at least on this stuff, and know what the rules are and why they're breaking them, are generally going to end up making better movies than people that just clearly don't have any clue about any of this stuff and are just kind of winging it and making up as they go along.
Let's give our listeners a couple of examples. Just this, we're not held to these grades because we're going to rewatch the movies, obviously. But based solely on memory, Steven, what would you give artistic merit and scientific intelligence for Gravity?
I would say that I think that it's definitely an A+ on the artistic scale and a solid A on the scientific scale.
Okay, for artistic merit, I would give Gravity an A. And for scientific intelligence, and again, this is coming from a guy who knows very little about real science, I would say B+.
Well, that's a cool thing for me. Like, what I think will be fun to explore in this podcast is what your impressions of which parts of the science are right and wrong as a layperson.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think will track with a lot of the audience, versus what an expert would say about those same things.
Right, and then conversely, as a film critic, I can simply tell you when you're wrong about a film, period.
That is correct.
Yeah. All right, well, so that is our introduction to science versus fiction. We are going to get into a pairing in just a second, but we wanted to just give you this one-time pilot episode intro to give you just a basic clue on what the show is going to be. And for the inaugural pairing on science versus fiction, we are going to be discussing David Tuohy's 1996 feature film debut, The Arrival, versus 2016's Arrival, directed by Denis Villeneuve. I hope I pronounced that right. And I am going to mention, written by Eric Heiser, adapted by the Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang. And as an aspiring screenwriter, I want to make it a point to always mention the writers on these films. And Stephen, if you don't correct me on that, I will be very upset. Explain to our listeners how we came upon this seemingly obvious pairing.
Well, so, I mean, the titles.
Well, I mean,
they're both movies about aliens showing up on Earth for the first time.
No, this kind of sucks because we did a lot of brainstorming on specific pairings, and then you go and say these two are just the title. And you know what? You are right. But, I mean, they both deal with the arrival of man's first contact with aliens on Earth. And they both deal with them in very disparate and kooky ways.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I think they are both very, very different movies on an artistic level and very, very different movies on a scientific level. And so they seemed like a really good pairing to sort of illustrate the overall concept of the show, which is like, here are these two contrasting movies about the same subject, and here are the things that they individually get right and individually get wrong.
It is worth noting that The Arrival pretty much gave David Tui his entire career, and it was a modest hit. People still like it. It definitely has its fans. After this, he would go on to do Pitch Black, Below, Chronicles of Riddick, Perfect Getaway, and Riddick. So I think we might be coming back to David Tui sometime in the near future. I'm a fan of his work, even though, Stephen, I'm not a big fan of The Arrival. Why don't you synopsize the plot for our listeners?
It is about Charlie Sheen, who plays the world's least believable astrophysicist.
And sweatiest,
whose fake sweat budget exceeded the budgets of our film, Found Footage 3D, I believe. And he discovers a signal from, purportedly from aliens, from space, that lets him know that there are apparently aliens already having arrived on the Earth. And then he is taken for a conspiracy theorist, and nobody believes him. Even though we see the aliens at one point.
That's the main problem with this movie. The main problem is that they show us that he and the awesome Richard Schiff, who everybody will know from The Lost World Jurassic Park, that he and Richard Schiff have seen and confirmed this signal. So if you want us to think throughout most of the movie that he's a slightly unhinged, sweaty crackpot, don't show us in the first 5 minutes that he is 100% right. He's immediately right. Everybody disagrees. Everyone stonewalls him, and his superiors are in on his vast conspiracy. And I can't remember a science fiction movie like this that starts out ostensibly fairly interesting, and then like every 15 minutes just gets less and less and less interesting.
It's very weirdly structured for sure. I mean, right from the beginning, you know, I love they put glasses on Charlie Sheen, and they're like, okay, well, he's an astrophysicist now because he's wearing glasses, and smart people wear glasses. That's certainly one of those tropes that I will point out every time it arrives on the movies that we watch.
Although I think it's a mediocre film, I will say, for the most part, Sheen earns his check. He does what he's, you know, like, he's never been Olivier, but he does a fair amount of heavy lifting in this movie, and he's not terrible in the movie. The other ostensible lead is Lindsay Krause, who seems to have like a twin subplot while Charlie Sheen is discovering this signal and then being blocked by all these different authorities and nefarious people. Lindsay Krause is looking into like greenhouse gas effects or something, and they cross paths in Mexico as Charlie Sheen is looking into his conspiracy. She gets bit by a scorpion and dies and never comes back. She's gone.
After inviting him into her hotel room to sleep with her, like 10 minutes after they met for the first time and had a conversation about conspiracies.
And his wife. They had a conversation about his wife. Yes. And I thought it was maybe a weird twist, and then she comes back later. But no, it's just...
Nope, the next time you see her, they're zipping her up in a body bag, and sorry.
It's a weird choice. It's like she quit the movie, and they're like, ah, shit, what can we do? Put her in bed, make her scream, and she's gone. I don't understand it. And then the rest of the movie is, I mean, there's a pretty interesting sequence where Sheen discovers the facility and goes underground and sees, you know, what the aliens ultimately are up to with some
early morphing technology.
And the extent of their skills seems to be twofold. They can generally copy what a normal human being looks like. Ron Silver plays two different bad guys in this.
One of them in brownface.
One of them in brownface as a Hispanic Ron Silver. And And that's one skill, that they can copy faces. And the other is they have knees that go back the other way.
Like, which makes them fast and jump.
Yeah. And I thought it was much less interesting when we discover in The Arrival that they're already here. Because the title is The Arrival, not they've right. been here. so I thought it was going to be an interesting movie about them arriving. And then it's more kind of a drier ripoff, not maybe not ripoff, but drier take on They Live, where, you know, he knows that there are these copycats out there who are faking being human and nobody will listen to him. And he seems like the crackpot. But
well, again, as you pointed out, like, it's such a baffling choice, because it could have actually really been an interesting movie if there had been some doubt as to whether or not he was a crackpot. If they had sort of played it in this sort of double way where, like, oh, maybe he's crazy and these things aren't real, or maybe these things are real and everybody just thinks he's crazy. And they had kind of, you know, then resolved that in the third act. But like you said, they show us right at the very beginning, and then midway through the movie, they show us the aliens, and we see the aliens. And it's not just Charlie Sheen seeing the aliens. Like, we see the aliens independent of Charlie Sheen, and therefore, like, okay, well, those, you know, the, in film grammar, that establishes these things are real. They're not just a figment of Charlie Sheen's imagination. And I feel like that whole third act would have, you know, or at least the second act and the early part of the third act would have worked a lot better if there had been some doubt as to whether or not he was just nuts.
Yeah, it almost feels like it starts like a sci-fi film noir in which there's this beleaguered guy who, you know, nobody believes him, and he's up against all these authoritarian figures, and there's dangerous women along the way who may or may not be on his side. And it feels kind of noir-y when it might have worked better as a character piece of, is he a kook or is he right? And then by showing us that the aliens are there, you start to think, well, I don't even care if he's a kook, because even if he is a kook, he could save humanity. And it has a really cool sequence atop a giant dish. Why don't you give me the technical term for that dish?
I mean, it's a radio antenna.
It's a radio antenna dish, and it is a really cool sequence. Some of it's faked, some of it's real, and you don't often get to see brawls on those giant, impressive dishes.
Not nearly as impressive as the one at the end of GoldenEye.
Okay, well, you know, not everybody can afford James Bond's budget, man. So, all right, a big problem with a movie like this is you spend every single moment of the movie with Charlie Sheen's Zane Zeminski. And here's the problem. It's not just that he's entirely unlikable, which he is. It's that there's no interesting point. There's lots of times where you're asked to watch an unlikable character. American Psycho is about an unlikable character, but he's interesting. So you're there to see like what he says and does next. Interesting. There's nothing there.
Like I said, he's the world's least believable astrophysicist, because you don't get a sense. Like, he doesn't even seem like a dumb person's version of a smart person. He seems like just a dumb person. Like, he doesn't seem like he actually has the intelligence to be an astronomer, which is an extremely intellectually demanding.
Is it now?
It is.
Said the astronomer. let me ask you this. We talked about this briefly the other day. Why don't you explain the second act diversion in which Charlie Sheen does some arcane, weird setup with a neighborhood full of satellite dishes?
Right. So, I guess this is a good segue into this sort of what the science gets wrong about this thing. So I guess Charlie Sheen at some point, it's not entirely clear. Either he becomes an employee of the cable company or he pretends to be an employee of the cable company. It's not entirely clear which one it is. But at some point, there's this montage of him going around to various people's houses and, you know, rigging up their satellite dish with fiber optic cable and whatever else so that he can then go back to his little attic headquarters and use all of their dishes as a radio array to be able to try to, because at this point he's been kicked out of his research institution because he found the aliens and the aliens turns out are his bosses. So they kick him out so that he can't discover anything more.
What are the odds on what you happen to discover that aliens exist and the next morning you find out your bosses are aliens?
Well, I would say that if you were an alien and you were invading Earth, having people placed in high positions at SETI institutions, so SETI is Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is what they're doing here. They don't discover the signal by accident. They establish in that opening scene that they're actually looking for alien signals. It's not like they happen to be astronomers and they stumbled on it. They're looking for it. And so, and they're apparently also looking for it where they shouldn't be looking for it, in the megahertz band instead of in the microwave band, which has its own bunch of scientific nonsense attached to it. But So he gets kicked out of the institution, and he decides the only way he can try to look for the signal is by building this big array of telescopes, which is actually, in principle, true. I mean, this is one of the ways that, in fact, that they recently discovered they recently took a picture of a black hole for the first time. And the way that they did that is they literally had radio telescopes on opposite sides of the Earth looking at this thing at the exact same time. And essentially what that does is it creates, resolution-wise, it creates a telescope that's basically the size of the Earth. So you can see things in a much, much greater detail. But in order to do that, you have to have highly specialized equipment. You have to know to within like nanometers how the exact distances between all of these different radio telescope arrays. And so the idea that he could sort of in an afternoon or in a couple days build this array and actually have it work and pick up the signal is complete nonsense.
Right. But beyond that, explain the much more practical reason it wouldn't work.
I mean, you know, this is setting aside the fact that the minute that he rigs all these dishes together, he goes back to his headquarters, and then he moves all of the dishes so that they point at this star that he discovered the signal from. Well, the minute he moves those dishes to point at that star, every single one of those 50 people is going to lose their TV signal. And all at once, they're going to call the cable company, and the cable company is going to come out, and they are going to talk to all of these people, and they're going to be like, yeah, this dude in glasses and who was really sweaty came in and tried to sell me this extra package of things, and he fiddled with the antenna. And like, it will take 5-10 minutes, maybe max, before the authorities are, you know, at his place going, dude, what are you doing?
I didn't even think of that until you told me about it. I said, yeah, you're right. Wait a minute. The minute he moves those dishes,
they're not pointed at the satellite that's giving them the TV feed anymore. And so those people are not going to have TV. Now, maybe it'll take them.
All right.
You know,
but now this leads to one of our show's most salient questions. Does the goofy dish array subplot and its faulty science detract from the movie?
Well, so again, it cuts both ways with that, because like I said, in theory, you could do that. And so you only have to suspend your disbelief so far to be like, okay, well, you know what? Like, this wouldn't work in practice because, you know, these dishes and the amplifiers that they're using would never be sensitive enough to actually, you know, work in this way. But at least they got the principle, right? Like, they understood that this is how you build a telescope array. And in fact, that's how they've built a lot of the SETI arrays. They have just this giant array. Rather than building one giant radio dish, you build a whole bunch of smaller ones, and then you link them all together. And so in principle, you know, that works. And so I'll give them points for understanding that that's how you would do that. And then you got to let the rest go. You got to go, okay, well, you know what? Like, it's a science fiction movie. You know, we can't see an hour of him fiddling with amplifier technology to try to get this thing to actually work, which is like 90% of what scientists do is get their equipment to actually work.
Now, what are your thoughts on the Richard Schiff character? Does he seem like more of a natural scientist than Charlie Sheen?
Oh, is he the guy at the beginning?
Yes.
Partner?
Yes.
No. I mean, not nobody reads as a believable scientist at any point in this entire thing. So I want to point out one little thing, and to me it's sort of emblematic of this movie as a whole and movies that get science wrong in general. In the very opening shots of this movie, as they're detecting the signal for the first time, he tells the guy to point the telescope to right ascension 7.36.7, and you see it flash on the screen, and declination 5.21. Now, any astronomer, even an amateur astronomer, would look at that and go, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. That is not how anybody... Like, the way right ascension works is basically it's like longitude, but projected out onto the sky. So it's measured in hours, minutes, and seconds. So if that is supposed to mean, 17.36.7 probably means 7 hours, 36 minutes, and 7 seconds, but nobody would ever say it that way or write it that way. No actual astronomer would say it that way or write it that way.
So where do you think a screenwriter comes up with that? Did he just like kind of...
Well, it's right enough to be like, so that clearly they did some amount of homework.
That's what I mean.
But like, then they got it wrong. Like, they literally had to just show that to an astronomer. Like, I don't know if it was the art department or the screenwriter or what, but like, and getting that right doesn't cost them anything. You can literally just call up an astronomer and ask them, and it doesn't affect the story in any way.
But how many people does it affect if they get it wrong?
But the point is that if to me, that signals, okay, these people aren't even willing to do the basic amount of homework to try to get any of this stuff right, because that's a very minimal thing no cost to get right.
So if you and I were writing a screenplay about, you know, a scientific, pinpoint equation, like longitude, latitude, like that, we would at least go, you know what, let's, for the hell of it, get it right. Let's Google it and get it right.
You know, it's like if you were watching a medical drama and, you know, the doctor's like, all right, we need to give him some anesthetic to cure his infection. And you're like, wait, no, that's not what anesthetic does.
Or even weirder is if they would just make up a medicine.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. Like they picked a right thing, but then got it wrong. And so it's like, I don't even understand how it happens, to be completely honest with you. Like they must have asked somebody, or he must have enough, you know, I guess this is the days before Google. But he must have consulted some sort of reference to get it, like, you know, 50% right. I don't understand how you then end up getting it 50% wrong in that case.
I think that in some cases, I would say in a movie like this, they're like for key science stuff, David Toohey probably did consult a scientist. And in other stuff where he thought, oh, you know, just a bunch of numbers, longitude, latitude, minutes, seconds. That's just minutia, and that doesn't need to be fact checked, you know.
Well, let me tell you a much more egregious thing, and this is a thing that, like, I think even a layperson, if they stop to think about it. So, one of the major plot points of this.
Oh, is it going to be that human physiology would not allow for our knees to buckle backwards like that?
Yes, that is also true. But I'm speaking more specifically of one of the major plot points at the very beginning of the movie is that they're supposed to be looking in the microwave band, and they decide instead to look in the megahertz band, and so they look at 107 megahertz. Now, you know, whether or not you know anything about, you know, what megahertz means and frequencies and all that stuff, let me just put it to you this way. Why it matters here is because, and they specifically say this in the movie, 107 megahertz is FM frequency, meaning literally like when you go into your car and you tune your radio to 107.1, you're tuning your radio to 107.1 megahertz. So like it's literally the frequency at which radios, you know, certain radio stations broadcast, which is how he ends up picking up the signal from Mexico. But that's exactly the reason why you would never in a million years look at that frequency for shit that you think is extraterrestrial in origin, because every signal that you get on that band is going to be from a radio station somewhere. And so the idea that they decided to look at this band that you can literally, and when at one point later on in the movie, he literally tunes that on his car radio, he tunes it to 107 megahertz. And that's what draws him down to Mexico, is they accidentally pick up this Mexican radio station. And so like all of this is like, wait, what? This doesn't make any sense at all.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You know what? When you explain it that way, it almost feels like the screenplay definitely was originally intended for him to be a crackpot. You know why? Because then he could just say, I followed this signal down to Mexico, and the scientist would say, yeah, you traced a Mexican radio signal.
Like, why would you think because you picked up a Mexican radio signal on the frequency where Mexican radio signals are supposed to be, that must mean that the aliens are in Mexico? Like, that makes no sense whatsoever.
It would be like looking for aliens in Detroit. It's like, you're
exactly. It's like, you know, I'm going to tune my radio and I picked up Hot 101 from out of New York. So the aliens must be in New York. Like what?
I'm going to give this movie a little bit of credit for being fairly prescient in one regard. And I think you'd agree with me. I don't know if it gets the science exactly right, but this film does have its heart in the right place as far as climate change is concerned.
Yes. And in fact, actually, it brings me to my next point, which is, this is true of this movie and also our Versus movie, is the convenient lecture, which is a staple of science fiction movies.
Oh, we should keep a running tally. It's a staple of not only science fiction, where it's the king, but also very prevalent in horror.
Yes.
Where when a screenwriter or a director wants the themes of the film to be thumped into your head. So in a horror film, the lecture or classroom scene is there generally to give you thematic heft or subtext. In a science fiction film, the lecture / schoolroom scene is more there to give you a bedrock of scientific information.
Right. And in this case, again, this has nothing to do with science. He walks into this lecture hall to try to find his boss after he gets fired. And there's a guy that happens to be giving a lecture about terraforming, which turns out to be the thing that the aliens are doing. And this guy just happens to be giving a lecture about how humans might one day terraform Mars. But the entire time he's giving this lecture, Charlie Sheen is walking around like tapping people on the shoulder going, have you seen whatever his boss's name is? Have you seen my boss? Have you seen my boss? He's not paying any attention to this lecture. 15 minutes later in the movie, he's in Mexico. He's talking to the greenhouse gas woman, and he has perfect recall of everything that this guy said in this lecture that he literally was not paying any attention to. That happened to be exactly the information that he needed to know at that exact moment.
Right, but was that was the stuff that he broke back, that he threw back at her at, scientifically accurate?
I mean, yeah, in broad sense, yes. Like, if you wanted to terraform something, you change the... I mean, that's what the aliens are doing, and in a sense, that's believable. Like, the aliens apparently need a planet that's warmer than ours is, and so they're dumping a bunch of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere to warm the Earth up. But what they, I guess, didn't realize – oh, well, they say this at one point. They're like, you know, you guys are doing this to yourselves, but we're just kind of speeding up the process a little bit.
Right, and that was one of the moments where I was like – I gave the film a couple of points for – you know, I don't think that Tui knew exactly what he was saying about global warming, but he definitely had a sense for it. It's not an arbitrary, you know, it could have been any nefarious plan. It could have been, you know, a rocket in the middle. It could have been blow up the core of the Earth. It could have been volcanoes, you know, but I think that he had a smart concept that global warming was going to be, it was an issue, is an issue, you know,
yeah.
Remains
and,
an issue.
And on that note, I think one last thing before we move on to our second movie of the week. The movie, Charlie Sheen, and thus the movie decides that, okay, well, these guys want a planet that's 10 degrees warmer so that they're comfortable living here. Therefore, their greatest nemesis must be cold. So let's hit the climax of the movie. We're going to blast them with a bunch of liquid nitrogen to freeze them.
Well, wait, that makes sense. If you and I are roommates and I want the heat on and you want the air conditioner on, all you have to do is shoot me with a fire extinguisher.
Exactly.
And I die.
But anybody dies if you shoot them with liquid nitrogen. Like, it's not.
Fair point.
It's just, it felt like a very on the nose metaphor. But in their defense, liquid nitrogen is a thing that you have just hanging around in almost every observatory, especially radio observatory. So it is in that sense a weapon of convenience to use against people if you need to, as I have had to many times.
I believe you. All right, so final thoughts on The Arrival. We're going with artistic merit and scientific intelligence. I'm going to go first because I don't know anything about science. So I'm going to give The Arrival, a podcast I enjoy very much called We Hate Movies would call this a hangover movie. It is certainly not painful to watch. It is has a couple of really interesting moments, some wacky, some legitimately good. But for the most part, it's fairly dry and uneventful. Charlie Sheen is not very likable, very sweaty, and I don't really care if he's crazy or if he's sane. I've seen this story told many, many times in Twilight Zone episodes much better. So, therefore, I will give The Arrival a C-. And for scientific legitimacy, I will give it a equally C-.
I think I would probably agree with you, honestly, on both of those assessments.
There you go. All right, there you go, The Arrival. Now, transition music. Woo! Now we move on to a fantastic science fiction film from 2016. It broke $100 million in America. It made just over $200 million worldwide, which blows me away because it has no action. It has no, like, explosive science, like, big tentpole explosion numbers. It is a contemplative, quiet, epic
cerebral.
It's brilliant. I love this movie. I think it's one of the best science fiction films of the last 10 years. And now we're going to talk about A Rival.
Yeah. I mean, I will say right off the bat, in contrast to The Rival, which impacted me on an emotional level at exactly zero.
Wait a minute. Boredom is an emotion.
Boredom is a lack of emotion. Whereas Arrival had me sobbing like a baby within 4 minutes, especially this time. Anything that has to do with dead kids just, you know, is a gut punch to a parent. So,
well, yeah. All right. Well, to clarify Stephen's blunt force trauma statement, Arrival opens with a bittersweet, heartbreaking montage in which it's clear that Amy Adams seems to be a single mother whose beautiful daughter passes away way, way too young. And then some years later, she is one of the world's leading linguists, and she is approached by Forrest Whitaker, military man, who says, we need you because a phalanx. Is that the right word, Stephen?
Yeah. I'll accept it.
All right. A dozen mysterious teardrop-shaped alien ships have appeared at various parts around the globe, and they have made some oral sounds, and I mean that with an AU in front. And so, you know, if something is giving off some form of communication, who do you go? You go to a linguist, and they tap her and Jeremy Renner, who is equally brilliant, but not quite as... let's say humane or in touch with the human creature. She has a lot more sweetness and soul to her, and he's more of a book smart guy. And together they head into the ships and start to decipher what these aliens could want. And man, it is, I will probably use this phrase a lot. It is kind of a slow burn, but it is never dull. There is not like a 15 minute stretch in this movie where you're like, they're just setting up the characters and they're setting up Act Three and it's a little dull and I'll wait for the good stuff. There's none of that. It's never dull.
The amount of talent required to make basically a movie about translating languages this gripping and this emotionally impactful is sort of off the scale.
I know you're much more avid reader, as is Randy. Have you read the source material?
I have. I've read this. This is one of my absolute favorite collections of short stories. It is mind-blowing in its just originality. This story doesn't even give you a feel for it. This is a very sort of traditional science fiction story. Some of the other stories in this book, like there's one about this group of apparently ancient Sumerian builders who are literally building a Tower of Babel and to try to reach the Vault of Heaven. There's ones about these people bringing homunculuses to life by sticking words into clay. It's fascinating. It's not a traditional science fiction collection at all. But
I have never read any of Ted Chiang's stuff, but I have to read the book this is in, because I've heard more than one person compare him to Philip K. Dick, if not superior. And we'll get to a lot of films based on Philip K. Dick in the future. And I am definitely going to read Story of Your Life and other stories. But let's move back to Arrival. Amy Adams, man, she can do no wrong.
She's a fantastic actress.
I mean, you look at her, she is like girl next door pretty. So immediately, you know, it's like she can play light and fun. But we've seen her play beaten down and brutal and vicious and smart and deeply compassionate in this movie. She is the soul of the movie, and she's like the entry point for the audience. And by opening it with such a heartbreaking tragedy, we're instantly empathetic. We instantly care for this woman. Yes. And that's not an accident.
No. And that, well, you know, and then what's amazing about it is that isn't just there to make you empathize with her.
No.
It comes back around at the end of the movie in a way that is just absolutely shocking. And is literally the point of the movie is that opening scene.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many, and like a lot of the films we're going to cover on this show, the beauty in Arrival is in its ambiguity. I mean, if you want to take that film and look at it in a very linear, or shall we say circular way, you can. But there are several different ways to, you know, permutations in which you can interpret this film. And I think it's absolutely beautiful. I think it's really cool as just like an adventure movie by nerds. And I mean nerds in the most affectionate way. This is a movie about like hardcore computer nerds and linguists who saved the day. It's made clear early and often in this film that not only is the military pointless, but it might be the only real threat in the movie is our own military. That, you know, yeah. They're not a threat at all. And they almost, the arrival of the ships acts as a reflection of us, because they land and they don't do anything. Talk about that, Steven. Talk about in a movie where the aliens land and they don't do anything, and then we just circle around and wait.
To me, like, one of my favorite things about sci-fi, and it's one of those things that works, almost always works better in books than it does in movies, and it's amazing that it works as well as it does here, is where the ideas themselves are what's driving the story. It's not just about, you know, like, okay, well, there's this kind of technology or you know, and now we're going to have a bunch of action set pieces around it. It's like the again, it's hard to talk about without spoiling it, but what do they call it? The Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in linguistics that she talks about sort of in the middle of the movie and this opening scene with her daughter. And then by the end of the movie, you're like, holy crap, those things were not just these sort of like asides to build texture and to make it sort of seem realer. These were like, again, literally the point of the movie. And that for that to come back around. It's one of the things that I love about one of my favorite sci-fi authors is Neal Stephenson. And in several of his books, particularly Anathem, he'll go off on a digression for five pages where two characters just sit there and geek out about quantum physics. And then, and you're like, okay, well, you know, that's just Neal Stephenson showing off. And then 300, 500, in some cases, several thousand pages later, in the case of The Broke Cycle, it'll suddenly be like, oh, wow, that thing that they were talking about is now not only like central to the plot, it's literally the point. And this movie does that really, really well.
It's kind of like the last movie and the satellite dish.
It's like Charlie Sheen's sweat in The Arrival, basically.
One thing that I love about this movie, and we also saw it, I believe, a few years ago in Spielberg's War of the Worlds, is that everything in Arrival is told from her eyes. We never cut away to the White House. We never, you know, I don't think there's one scene.
It does a few news montages, I think, just to sort of catch you up on what's happening.
Right, but it's also when she's seeing them. Right.
That's one of the things I loved about Signs as well. It's very similar. It's like, okay, this is what it would feel like if you were kind of cut off in the middle of nowhere without access to the president and whatever else. Like, it's not built like a disaster movie. It's built like a character drama, and you only know what the characters know.
Right. And that's what I kept half expecting the movie. I mean, by halfway through, you realize they're not going to. But when you keep expecting that conventional cutaway to the military and the president saying, so we don't know what they want. You tell me, Secretary of State. And we don't have any of that. It's only about this small group at this one ship.
Well, and that adds a lot of tension as well, because there are times when Forrest Whitaker is relaying information that clearly is important to the people that are literally running this entire project, and he's telling it to Amy Adams as if this is the word, this is law, this is what's going to happen right now, and she's kind of thrown for a loop by it and trying to sort of explain to him, knowing that he's now going to have to go explain it to his superior, who's going to have to explain it to his superior, and somewhere along the line, whoever makes this decision is going to have to be convinced, and she's not ever able to get in a room with this person, and there's a way in which that does mirror sometimes some scientific process, and certainly corporate processes where like a decision gets made at such a high level that the people that it's impacting and the people who know best what the right decision is in that moment are never part of the process of actually making the decision. And they pull a lot of tension out of that because she's frustrated constantly by this process.
Tension, good word, leads us to one of the best sequences in the movie in which Jeremy Renner gets to actually be a proactive ally slash heroic friend. I am hot and cold on Jeremy Renner, and I really like the way they use him here. He's quite good, and it's not just how they use him, but it's also he's a talented actor. He is. And I like that at the beginning he's almost not very likable, and then in each progressive scene he thaws out and becomes more human, and it seems because it's his contact with her, she allows him to become more human and more likable. And then when it gets to them, you know, at the end, maybe or maybe not having a romantic moment, it just fits perfectly. The screenplay is a masterpiece. You can't always judge a screenplay by a finished film, but you can tell when a screenplay was brilliant if the film is great. you know what I mean? Like, I think it's one of the best screenplays of the last several years, especially in science fiction. And it really feels like it came from, like, if you or I read a short story and were so inspired, we adapted it into a spec and Eric Heisserer happened to get it made. God bless him.
Speaking of Jeremy Renner's character, one of the only sort of gripes I have with this movie on a scientific level is the decision to make Jeremy Renner's character a theoretical physicist. I don't understand that on any level. And I can't remember, honestly, whether that comes directly from the book or not. But in any case, that is not who you would hire to do that job. Like, obviously, it makes sense that she's a linguist. You'd bring a linguist in to come in and try to decipher the language. But he's ostensibly in charge of the scientific team. But theoretical physicists, by and large, work solo or maybe in pairs. They are not the kind of people who are in charge of teams.
Here's how I would write it. Why is he in charge? He's a theoretical physicist. This is a practical spaceship.
Exactly. Like, it makes no sense to me. Like, it's like, it feels like they just were like, okay, well, what can we use as a stand-in for, like, super smart person? Okay, well, Einstein was a theoretical physicist. Newton was a theoretical physicist. Let's just make him a theoretical physicist. Well, you know, there's a reason why. I mean, Newton was a complete misanthrope. Einstein was apparently a little bit more pleasant than that. But again, most of his work was literally him sitting in a room by himself doing stuff. Whereas I, for several semesters when I was at UT, I TA'd for a course called Extraterrestrial Life. That there are literally people who have in astronomy who, you know, kind of a little bit as a side field and sometimes as research that they publish, study what you know, and try to figure out what the biology of extraterrestrials might be like and how that would affect, you know, how we would detect them and things like that. There's literally a discipline called astrobiology. And so at the very least, having an astrobiologist on the team would make some sense. And if you were – they established Jeremy Renner as the leader of the team. And if you're going to be the leader of a team, then again, you need to be the kind of person who has led a team, which is going to be at the very least some sort of observational or experimental physicist who often lead very, very large teams of people towards its common scientific goals.
Okay, okay. So you admit that it's a minor gripe, but if you're rewriting Arrival, what do you make Jeremy Renner?
Well, like I said, I would either make him, you know, some sort of a – he would probably – well, this is, you know, he would probably be older, to be completely frank, because, again, the kind of people that are – because they establish him as a leadership role. Like that's the main – that's his main contribution, according to the screenplay, is that he's in charge of the team. And so I would put somebody that theoretically has, no pun intended, the experience of being in charge of a team of scientists. Okay. Whereas, and his being the other thing is that his being a theoretical physicist never comes to bear. It's not like he, you know, at some point has some sort of insight about theoretical physics that allows him to crack the case. Like, it's not a thing that's ever, they just literally name him that at the beginning, and then it's never, and so like naming him something else, telling us that he was a the guy that was in charge of Los Alamos or the guy who was in charge of CERN, you know, would be somebody that you would think would be a better choice.
I have one, it's a minor gripe too, but it's a very simple movie convention, so I get it. Why does Michael Stuhlbarg have to be the guy who just contradicts everything?
Oh, the guy from, yeah.
Why do you always have to have somebody? Can't you have that person occasionally not contradict? So then, therefore,
you gotta have conflict, I guess. And so, yeah. Like everybody.
No,
can't.
But by the grammar of film, by the third or fourth time, you're now telling the audience they're just gonna refute anything you say, as opposed to them being a more well-rounded character who has it confessed to being wrong a few times, you know?
Yeah.
And it just seems more of a convention for, like, you would just have this one more roadblock is this guy who never listens. Occasionally it says, you're right. Literally.
Well, I mean, it's literally the only thing we know about him is it is the only character trait. He's there to deliver, like, conflict. He's not a character, really. He's a function within the screenplay. And that's, you know, one of its rare sort of missteps is that he doesn't feel like, even in a small way, it doesn't feel like a well-rounded. Whereas, like, Forrest Whitaker feels, you know, you don't get to learn a whole lot about him, but he feels his own inner life. He has his own, like, he's doing things because they make sense to him as a character.
Oh, there are moments with the, he plays Colonel Weber. There are moments where he is completely by the book and automaton-ish. And then there are moments where he clearly chooses to side with her because he believes she's right. And that's right. So, you know, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. But, you know, these are all very, very minor gripes, in my opinion.
Also, on the minor gripe front, the last and only other piece of science that I'll point out about this movie that bugged me, and this is a thing that I'm probably going to be pointing out over and over and over and over again every single time we talk about a movie that takes place – well, this one doesn't take place in space, but it involves spacesuits. You don't put lights in helmets shining in people's eyes or they can't see anything. And I understand from a film point of view why you have to do that. You have to, like, see their faces. You're paying Jeremy Renner $2 million to be in this movie. You want to see his face. But every single movie does this, and every single time it takes – I'm just like, how does this person see anything? How do they see anything? There's a light shining directly in their eyes.
I dare you to tell someone like Denis Villeneuve or Ridley Scott that they cannot light their beautiful women and man actors and just put those lights right on those cheekbones and those eyes and those eyebrows and be like
– Kubrick did it.
Yeah.
And it was just fine.
Well, he had cure delay. It's not quite the same thing as Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner. I'm sorry.
But they don't even spend that long in the spacesuits. And I watched it specifically for this time. They don't do anything particularly emotive in the moments. Like in this movie in particular, like some movies, they're in spacesuits for a long time and you kind of need to see their faces in various different scenes. In this one, they're only in the spacesuits a little bit. But like,
and you know what? The spacesuits only exist for two reasons. One, so obviously to be realistic. And two, for the moment
when you take it off.
Exactly. For the moment when she says, oh, I don't need this. But yeah, what we should come up with a new scale for spacesuit design, because every movie that we see is going to probably almost every movie is going to have a spacesuit. And I got to say, I think the design on this one is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, they had the advantage in this one that they didn't have to be pressurized suits, and so they were able to, you know, be a little bit more comfortable. You know, real spacesuits in space have to be pressurized; they have to be filled with air, yeah. And so they get bulkier and they get much, much harder to sort of move around in. Whereas here, there was no pressure differential; they just were kind of there to be a safety system.
Give me your physicist's take on the shape and design of the ships themselves.
I mean, as a physicist, I don't know that they make any sense. But then again, as Arthur C. Clarke once said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So we don't have any idea. I mean,
I think Tolkien said that.
It was Clarke. from our understanding of physics, things like anti-gravity, if they could exist, would be enormously expensive from an energy expenditure point of view. But again, you have to just kind of throw up your hands and go, you know what? They're aliens. They have a completely different way of thinking about things. They're millions of years advanced from us. So they've figured out some way to counteract gravity. From an artistic point of view, I loved the design of those ships. And I especially loved the way that they departed.
Yeah.
They didn't go fly off into space. They kind of disappear into this fog.
No, they kind of got Thanos snapped. That's what happened there.
Basically, yeah. And so I thought that was really interesting. Oh, which, speaking of design.
Yeah, about the design of the aliens.
Yeah, so one of the things that I absolutely love about this movie that so many alien movies get wrong, including The Arrival, is that the aliens feel truly alien. Like there's nothing about them, not the way they talk, the way that they write, the fact that they're talking and they're writing are not linked to one another like they are in every human language. The design of them, the environment that they're in, the ships that they build, like nothing about these aliens feels anything other than just alien. Whereas, you know, for obvious reasons, in a lot of alien invasion movies, they got to put guys in suits. And so, you know, the aliens are some form of humanoid. And the idea that, like, if we encountered aliens, they'd have two legs and two arms and just, you know, a slightly different forehead than human beings is, of course, you know, silly on a scientific level.
So now you hate Klingons. I see. I got it. Okay.
But, you know, for a TV show or for a lower budget movie, you have to do that sort of by necessity. I love that they had the budget here to make these things completely different than any alien you've ever seen before. And again, alien, just they're almost inscrutable.
Yeah.
And that's part of what leads to the fear of the, you know, the people in the movie, especially the military people, because it's like, well, we don't have any idea. They're not making any sort of aggressive moves, but they're so completely different from us that we don't have the slightest idea what their intentions are.
Do you recall how they were described in the book?
That's how they're described in the book. They're heptapods in their writing. I don't know if they had the circular writing. I think that was something they came up with. In the book, they just described their writing as being, it didn't matter what order things were in.
Right.
Everything could just be sort of jumbled up together. And I think it was, Dels Villeneuve and his team that decided to sort of make it this sort of circular writing glyph sort of system, which I think was a good visual solution to that problem. They were described as heptapods in the book.
Well, I got to say that over the last 10, 12 years, I think that people will look back on this era as a mini renaissance of smart, big budget sci-fi movies, because they're, you know, they're really, gravity led to like The Martian, and The Martian led to this, and or the other way around. But I mean, we've had a lot of them in the last several years, and I think Arrival ranks among the very best. I give it an A for artistic merit, and since I know nothing about science, I'm going to say an A for scientific veracity.
Yeah, I would agree with both of those. I think that it's definitely an A for artistic merit, and you know, maybe an A minus. I'm going to knock off half a letter grade for the egregious use of Jeremy Renner. But other than that, and one other point actually as well. The Amy Adams, I know that I have linguist friends who are upset about the fact that linguists are always portrayed as being really, really good at learning languages, which is a totally separate skill from studying the underlying structure of a language. And there's certainly some overlap between those things. But a linguist and a polyglot are not the same thing.
That's interesting. I never thought of that, that if you are portrayed in the film as somebody who knows five or six languages, it's because you are a savant in some way.
Well, I mean, there are some people who, like my little brother speaks 5 or 6 languages just because he's lived in various places in the world and he's good at picking them up. He couldn't tell you like what the grammar of Haitian Creole right. is, whereas a linguist might be able to tell you all about the grammar of Haitian Creole, but if you tried to teach them Spanish, they wouldn't be able to learn it very quickly. So,
dude, I can barely speak English.
Well, that's clear.
All right. So thank you so much for tuning in to the first and pilot episode of Science versus Fiction. The arrival versus arrival, both fun, one brilliant, one stupid. I want to thank you all for listening. We're going to come back in episode 2 with what we don't know. Maybe Armageddon versus Deep Impact. Maybe
or aliens versus Starship Troopers. It's another possibility.
Or Independence Day versus Mars Attacks is another option.
World War Z versus Resident Evil.
Yeah, and all kinds of stuff. All kinds of not just outer space stuff, but science fiction, Earth-based, and all the stuff in between. So tune in next time for Science versus Fiction. Thanks.
Bye.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.